The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, July 14th, the Power Frows edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
June, shouldn't we introduce you as the editor of also XX, since it's relevant to our show and you do now edit XX some of the days?
I only edit it one day a week, but sure. I mean, I do many things. I was on Hannah
okay,
Listen
about,
this week.
She's the keeper.
And the 1/5 editor of XX.
The keeper of all things gender at Slate, right?
Is that
right? Yeah. Queen of gender, yes.
Okay.
Queen of gender is a complicated phrase, Hannah, possibly even problematic.
Yeah, because Brian might want that phrase.
Yeah, that's
you might
true.
Want that, title.
That belongs to the man. Well, I'm glad to be back, all of us together. It has been a long time, so I'm excited to be here. With
oh,
all
that's
you.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, we've missed a few episodes. It's always been one or another of us. Okay, well, today we are going to discuss Britain's new prime minister is a woman. Yay. But does she only get to take over because men have made a mess of things? Second, is Roger Ailes the next Bill Cosby? Am I allowed to say that? You think that's fair, Noreen?
I think that's a fair framing.
Okay. All right. We'll get into it. We'll get into it. But we'll just say that's fair for now. We'll frame it the Fox way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is Roger Ailes the next Bill Cosby?
News at 11.
News at 11.
And next... I'm wearing a short skirt while we talk about this with my legs crossed in heels. That's the Fox way.
Yeah, well, Noreen, you know what? If you want to play with the big boys, you have to lay with the big boys.
We should save this for the segment.
Save it for the segment. But since you mentioned your short skirt, I just thought I would sexually harass you on air. Anyway, okay, finally, the Bachelor franchise. Why has it lasted so long? And of course, we'll talk about Unreal, a show about a fictional Bachelor-type show and how it gets put together. And also, for Slate Plus listeners, we have a special segment today. Is air conditioning sexist? All right, let's start with our first topic. Britain's new prime minister is a woman, Theresa May. She's a lifelong politician, she's a leader of the Conservative Party, and she has been described as a safe pair of hands to guide them through troubled times. But as June, our own June Thomas, asked in her recent Slate piece, does this sudden rise of female power in the UK come at a time when Britain is in a stonking great mess?
The answer
June,
to that question is yes.
What does stonking mean?
It's just really big. So stonking great mess is a really, really big mess.
It's not related to stinking?
No, I don't think so.
I love that word, stonking.
It adds stress and emphasis. It's one of those words.
It's a beautiful word, stonking. Anyway, so June, can you tell us a teeny bit about Theresa May before we dive into the gender and the meaning and the politics of her rise?
Yeah, so she has been the Home Secretary for the last 10 years, which is a very long time to do that job. It's one of the four big departments of state, so it's one of the four leadership positions, one of the four most important jobs in British government. And typically, it's a sort of career killer because it's just very, very difficult. Not that people kind of leave politics in disgrace, but they tend not to move up the ladder after that. So they tend not to become prime minister because it involves things like policing and security and immigration that are just very sort of hot button issues. And so typically that's the end of a person's rise. But she has had the job for 6 years, which is the longest run in a century. And she's, by all accounts, done a decent job. As is always the case with that department, there have been some controversial decisions that she's made and some tough things that she's had to do. But in general, for a conservative, and we have to say that she is a conservative and she's the leader of the Conservative Party and they are not progressive, she has been a pretty progressive conservative. Like she, pushed for a couple of inquiries into police corruption. She's brought the police to account on some historical things. She's really pushed in terms of like human trafficking, and she's decent on women, which is something that you couldn't say for Margaret Thatcher, her predecessor as female prime minister from the.
What does decent on women mean? Like, what is the thing that she's promoted from women?
So she has been good on rape, for example.
No.
She's generally been considered to be, especially for a conservative, to have stuck up for the rights of rape victims in the judicial system.
Now, from reading the British press, it sounds like she's, like people describe her as a certain type. You know, like capable, like that's the words you hear, sort of competent, capable. The insulting word, which I love, I'm sorry to say, is Powerfrau, you know, sort of capable and drama free. Like someone in an article mentioned Golda Meir is the kind of type.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, totally. I mean, and, you know, we can get into this, but there is indeed this whole swath of this kind of politician that seems to be on the rise. I would say that she has been somebody who is, you know, she's so capable. As I said, she's stayed in a very tough job. She's done, you know, received overall favorable reviews for her performance in that job. And the reason that she is now leader of the Conservative Party and therefore the Prime Minister is that everything around her went into this giant ball of drama that just kind of blew up into flames and then put on like a fireworks show. And meanwhile, she was being like the normal adult that wasn't melting down or fighting with their best friend. She apparently tends to stay out of, like, she doesn't have super tight friendships. Like, she's nobody's mentor. She's not been anybody's, you know, right-hand woman. She's kind of typically been standing slightly to the side, just doing
and nobody's job. Mother. That came up too. She's
it
nobody's
sure did.
Mother.
Yeah. In the end, there wasn't a leadership race with Andrea Leadsom. It was supposed to be, but Andrea Leadsom dropped out after only one weekend into what should have been like a 2 month campaign. Partly because the bottom line is that she wasn't experienced enough. But she, in her first big interview with the Times, made a comment which she has. You know, said that maybe she didn't say exactly what was reported, but that...
Or that they trapped her into saying it.
Yeah. So she, in an interview with the Times reporter Rachel Sylvester, she said that as a mother, she would be a better leader because she, you know, has this stake in the future and that Theresa May isn't a mother. Well, Theresa May had spoken publicly on other occasions about the pain of not being able to have children, that she and her husband wanted very much to have children, and it just didn't happen for them. And that caused her sadness. And so then there was this kind of uproar about, oh my God, how dare you play on that? How dare you, you know, use that as a weapon in this campaign? And that was one of the things that essentially made Andrea Leadsom realize that she just couldn't handle the scrutiny. You know, it was useful that, you know,
but
came up so soon.
That moment was so interesting that it resonated because essentially the way the press described it is it was a big mistake to say that because, in fact, you need a kind of childless – this is – I'm not saying this is true. I'm saying this is what it looked like, the optics, that what you need is a childless mother figure Powerfrau. Like she needed to step in and be the mother of the nation but not actually have children. Like, you don't want an actual woman who has actual children, but you want someone to be the mother / nanny figure to come and save the country at that moment.
Well, and didn't some politician actually say, we need the nanny to step in and we'll feel better, which I found so British.
Yeah, so British. I know. And it really was that sort of let nanny tell us what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is. There's always, you know, and it's a harsh, rather... you know, unbending, not necessarily terribly warm woman who's not really going to comfort you and hug you. She's just going to kind of get you on the right path and sort of tell you to straighten up and get on with the job.
So it's a nanny, not a mother. It's not a mother figure. It's a nanny.
It's a harsh nanny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even a conservative can run a nanny state.
Oh, they're the ones who do it.
Yeah. I was very interested in the way that she turned an insult that was used against her by a political rival into a compliment. So, June, I'm going to – who called her a bloody difficult woman?
Yeah, so Ken Clark, he's the MP for an area in Nottingham where I used to live, as a matter of fact. But he is kind of an elder statesman of the party. He's in his 70s. He's an old guy, and he's a great talker. He's really smart. He's had a lot of experience in politics. And they love to have him on TV and radio shows because he just says things, but not ridiculous things. He's very smart, but he's not necessarily the most careful speaker in some ways.
He's the Barney Frank of Britain? No?
I mean, different, but in the sense of being a good talker. You can actually understand what Ken Clark says also. Anyway, oops. This was actually caught. This was not supposed to be on mic. He was mic'd up, but he wasn't, like, the cameras weren't on him. It was just kind of caught on tape. He was talking about all of them, and he described Theresa May as a bloody difficult woman, which he didn't necessarily mean as a criticism.
Right. And she then was like, all right, I'm going to go with this. And she said, I sure am a bloody difficult woman. And the next person who's going to find that out is the president of the EU as right. I'm negotiating the Brexit. But wait, can we just pause and talk about my other favorite off mic moment, which has nothing to do with gender? the humming, the David Cameron humming. So this is like Armando Iannucci is scripting this whole thing. It really is to me. Like he's scripting the whole thing. So David Cameron was saying that Theresa May was going to take over, and he was still mic'd as he walked away. And he begins, as he walks in the door, he begins humming something that someone on Twitter identified as like a Shostakovich symphony, I believe. But whatever. It was just like him being like, and then he goes, right. Good. And it was just the most stiff upper lip British thing ever. It was so amazing.
And that came after what really was, I mean, a shocking moment. Like the last 2 weeks have been absolutely wackadoo in Britain. So much has happened that was not expected. Nothing has really happened that should have happened, but still. So that was a big surprise when he went out there and said he was stepping down immediately. And yeah, that hum at the end of like, yes, you know.
I interpreted it as like self-soothing. Like he was just like, this is okay, right.
It's like the car driving your entire village just goes off the cliff and you're like, right. Good. Yeah, very good. Very
well. It was like a rom-com, like Hugh Grant, like.
Well, now he can make his rom-com. I mean, he's off the hook now. He can do whatever he wants.
True. All right. So can I steer us to the actual question we said that we were going to answer this or discuss for the last few minutes of this?
Yes.
Which is this question of the glass cliff.
Yes.
June, can you explain what is the glass cliff?
So the glass cliff in business is this phrase that's used to explain how when women come into leadership positions, it tends to be at a time when everything is in flames and the men who've caused the problems are scattering, and they give the woman the job and say, here, this thing is a mess right now, but we want you to take over. The first female CEO typically comes in when everything is in crisis and the stock is tanking and just, you know, recalls are happening. That's the typical situation. And
that's what Carly Fiorina said happened to her, right? That was her excuse.
And you remember
happened.
We talked about it on the show when when General Motors announced their first female CEO.
Right, right. So it is a thing. It's a genuine thing.
It's a genuine thing.
Well, and do we think it's a sexist thing? Like, why do we think it happens?
I don't know. I was trying to think about this, and I was trying to think about it in the context of Hillary Clinton, who, in all likelihood, knock on the wood of...
Knock on this glass table that we use so that we can check out everybody's legs.
So in all likelihood, Hillary Clinton will be the first female president of the United States pretty soon. Is she just getting elected because there are terrible things happening in the country? Like, it's not that the economy is in the tank. It's not that this president is unpopular, which it seems like, you know, has been the case in other places. But there is definitely a swirling sense of fear in America right now. So is there something about Hillary Clinton that feels comforting and capable that maybe people will cotton on to?
I want to definitely hear what Hannah has to say about that. But I will say that it is slightly different in a presidential system. I mean, typically when women, the sort of female politician version of the glass cliff happens in parliamentary systems, when, you know, we're there, it's all about who's leader of a party. The person who's leader of the party, that person becomes prime minister if that party wins the majority or, you know, forms a government. And so it's almost like there's less stress to become a leader of a party than to be elected as president.
So it's not that the people of the country are the ones looking for the mother figure. It's the people who are sort of the smaller group of elites who have done the fucking up are the ones who are looking for the mother figure to
I
come
suppose
in.
That's right. Or typically what happens, I think, is that men scatter because they think, oh, we're not going to win this next time around. This is like a poison chalice. So I'll let the woman take this right now because this is a shit show. And then I'll come back later and take my chance when there's actually a chance of doing well. So I think that in politics, that's what happens in a parliamentary system. It's slightly different with Hillary because we have a different system here. But Hannah, what do you think about how Hillary's the situation that Hillary's stepping into?
I do think there's something to the yin yang. It's Trump who makes us more fearful and seems like chaos. And so I think the things that are good about Hillary, you know, these sort of nanny qualities that she's capable and that she's experienced and steady, somehow come more into relief when she has this other person as the alternative. It is a little bit sexist. I mean, in a sort of deeply Freudian way, as we discussed, like we need our mommy nanny to save us. On the other hand, I think minorities who are not in power, and that is true of women at the highest levels of power, like this is an opportunity, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, what would be terrible is if the women get into power and then that's it. Like that's their only chance. Do you know what I mean? It's just like the one woman in power and you never get another opportunity. But it's usually special circumstances when people who are not normally in power get elected. So let this be the special circumstance and then turn it, right? Yeah. Like if Hillary gets elected, like my youngest child will never know a white male president. Yeah. And so like it will be completely normal to him that, you know, president is a black man or a woman. And then it just becomes normalized. So even though it's not the best way to come to power, as long as it, you know, as long as it doesn't truly completely set her up. I mean, Margaret Thatcher came to power in a similar way and then, you know, was solid.
Right.
I mean, maybe not, you don't like her, but she was solid. She's not thought of as a person who came and saved a mess and then died.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's the thing that I, in many ways, I hate Thatcher and everything she stood for, but you can't help but admire how effective she was. She was a brilliant politician. And there, you know, it has often worked that a woman comes in a sort of weird situation and thrives. I mean, Angela Merkel, you know, took over the Christian Democratic Union when there had been this big scandal in the party. So she kind of rejected the men who had been the leaders and her mentors. And, you know, it could just have been a little interregnum. And she's been the leader since, I think, what, 2005? So 11 years so far. But like in Canada, Kim Campbell came in as leader of the Progressive Conservatives, who were in power at the time after Brian Mulroney, who had become an extremely unpopular prime minister and an unpopular leader and an unpopular man, had been in power and was, and you know, the other people in the party didn't want the job because they thought like, the party's going to be rejected. We're going to be out of power. Let's hold on. Let's kind of keep our powder dry. Kim Campbell, who was pretty well thought of, didn't do a very good campaign, it's true. But the way that the party was absolutely decimated and, in fact, went from being the, you know, the party of government to having two seats, I mean, which is we can't even conceive of something like that in this country. You know, and she, so that's now how Kim Campbell and Canada's female prime minister was remembered. And that was pretty much a disaster.
I can't believe you worked us around to Canadian politics.
I know.
We let you talk about British politics and you took it to Canada.
I took it to Canada. It in there.
I got Ottawa in there.
All right. Well, let's just end this on saying that we could have a year where we have Theresa May, Angela Merkel, and Hillary Clinton. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That's the UK, the US, and Germany, all run by the Power Frows, or the Femocracy. Yeah. Is that how you pronounce that word?
I think so. That would be three of the G7 leaders, yeah.
I know. That's amazing. That's amazing. Power Frows in. Okay. Let's move on to our second topic, the sexual harassment suit against Roger Ailes. But before we do that, let's hear from our sponsor. All right, Roger Ailes, chairman of Fox News, Republican operative. He's been accused by TV anchor Gretchen Carlson of sexual harassment. Since then, several more women have come forward and made similar accusations. These accusations date back to the 60s, and the language is straight out of a bad pulp novel, such as the move I made on Noreen, which didn't take earlier in the show. If you want to play with the big boys, you have to lay with the big boy. Can you imagine those words coming out of your mouth?
That's what's so shocking about this whole thing is how, like, almost unimaginative it is. It's like he saw some, I don't know, like, B-movie or porno about a boss, like, exploiting women and just borrowed those moves, and that he's still doing it in 2015.
Allegedly, still doing it.
Well, that's the amazing thing. Like in the 60s, you kind of feel like the world of work was a Stanley Kubrick movie, and especially the world of work like in Hollywood. Like it was, when you read the testimonies of, it's like the Cosby thing. Like when you read what happened in the 60s, how kind of young, vulnerable, aspiring, you know, actresses and anchors were put in these positions, you just want to throw, like, it's so oppressive. Like, they would be ushered into this room with him. He would say these terrible things, and they had no power, and he would just dismiss them, right? Allegedly, really, allegedly. Like, this is at the very beginning of these things. But 2005, like, that he still was, he was 75 years old. Right. If he said, if Gretchen Carlson is telling the truth and he said what he said to her, he was, you know, a great grandpa age.
Yeah. That's not a great grandpa.
Okay, grandpa age. Fine, grandpa age. Fine, grandpa age. So what is Gretchen Carlson saying?
So last September, Gretchen Carlson was in the beginning stages of renegotiating her contract, I believe. It was a meeting with Roger Ailes, who's essentially her boss, to talk about the state of her contract. And during that meeting, he said, according to her, "I think you and I should have had a sexual relationship a long time ago. Then you'd be good and better and I'd be good and better," which is such a weird phrase. Mm-hmm. It's such a weird phrase. You like couldn't make it up, you know?
Right.
And so then nothing happens publicly for 9 months or so. Is that 9 months? Until just recently, when Gretchen Carlson's contract was not renewed. And then she came forward to allege this sexual harassment. Ailes denies. His team has produced a thank you note that she sent him after that meeting. Her team says that's, you know, she went to a meeting with the boss. She sent a thank you note. She wrote a piece, I believe, in the Huffington Post about sexual harassment that she'd experienced earlier in her career. She was Miss America. She worked her way up through local news stations. This was not the first guy to come on to her, either, you know, to try to get her to advance her career or just to be creepy. And then since Carlson went public, six other women have come forward. There were women. My colleague Gabe Sherman wrote a book a few years ago, about Roger Ailes. There were accusations against him in that book. There seems to be a bit of a pattern emerging. So
that's the part, by the way, that reminded me of Cosby.
Right.
Is that the MO and the idiom, like the women seem to remember with great specificity things he said. And though the words were different in every case, the idiom was similar.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way he made the move and the types of things that he said really echoed each other in all six of these cases.
And the idea just generally running through both of these situations is a man with a great deal of power sort of enjoying and trying to use that power imbalance over women. I mean, and that's the thing. Like Gretchen Carlson has so much power in the world. Mm-hmm. And yet in that room with Roger Ailes, she doesn't compared to him, you know?
Christina Carterucci had a piece in Slate last week, and she said, "No amount of power, fame, or success can insulate women from gender-based mistreatment on the job," based on, you know, if this is happening to Gretchen Carlson, ..
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I know that all of these things should not shock me, but in a way, that is shocking. Like,
yeah,
she's married to this big shot sports agent. He has more powerful than her, but she's not a powerless person.
Right.
Well, what's interesting to me, well, how about this? What if there's a culture at Fox? There's always sort of mild misogyny, kind of stupid things said about women and kind of the properness of gender relationships on Fox. I mean, that's the thing that I love about this story is that even at Fox, I mean, the Murdochs are taking it seriously. The Murdochs are not dismissing it. I mean, people are lining up on either side, but the Murdochs at least said they were going to investigate this and take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So even at Fox, a place where people casually say sexist things, you know, maybe it's just that she tolerated it in that atmosphere. It was like, ha 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 ha, like in a jokey way. And then suddenly even there, it's unacceptable.
Well, I mean, I think the whole thing with the Murdochs, you know, the next generation, Lachlan and his brother, whose name currently escapes me, I think there is a generational struggle within Fox News that, you know, Roger Ailes is 76. His contract was renewed last year.
And the kids don't necessarily like him, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I think they may be seizing on an opportunity to, you know, get rid of their dad's guy. I mean, in that kind of family, there's always generational fights and inter-brother fights and all that stuff.
So it might not shift some big cultural... So it might not signal some big cultural shift. It's just a power play.
I think it might.
I think it's also...
It's been an interesting year. There's been this thing baked into the culture, sort of the Fox News blonde, right? Mm-hmm. Which I've made jokes about, right? It's like they only are allowed to be blonde. Everyone's made up in a certain way. And just in the past year, there's been all the Megyn Kelly versus Trump stuff. And yes, she ultimately came back to Fox News. She hasn't really commented on this Roger Ailes thing. But for a while there, she was sort of like flying the feminist flag. Now there's this Gretchen Carlson situation. I think it's just been an interesting year for the mask that women at Fox are asked to put on. There's been some real emotion poking out behind it. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
Now, what do you guys think? There's been pressure. So there's been people lining up on the Ailes side, testimonies, namely most notably Greta Van Susteren, and then people lining up on the Gretchen side. And then there's been pressure on Megyn Kelly to say something. What do you guys think about that? Is it incumbent on her as a fellow sister at Fox to say one thing or another about Roger Ailes?
That's a tough one, right?
I mean, I think if she doesn't know, she doesn't know, right?
Right.
Like you,
right.
It doesn't just because he pulled this one on Gretchen doesn't mean he pulled it on every single woman,
right?
You know, the experience of being in a room with Megyn Kelly might be different than the experience of being in a room with Gretchen Carlson, and he tried one and not. Who knows?
Right.
You know?
Who knows? I think it is a little. So let's say that something that Roger Ailes did sort of do the same thing to Megyn Kelly, hypothetically, to be clear. I don't know that you can ever. I think to come forward and allege sexual harassment or sexual assault, it's like really brave when you do it, but I don't think that you can ever expect any woman to go in the public eye and do that necessarily. It's like a choice that she has to make for herself. And for people to put pressure on a woman to comment on something like that, I think is a little unfair. I don't know. What do you think, June?
I tend to agree. I mean, if Megyn Kelly has knowledge of something involving Roger Ailes and inappropriate behavior with women, then it would be nice if she did. But if she doesn't say anything, I don't know if that means that she doesn't know anything, has no negative experience, or is choosing not to say for the reasons of her career. I don't know, and I don't know that any of us can know what a silence would mean. If she came forward and said, yes, he did these bad things to me, that's different. But I don't know. I don't think that we can prejudge before we know what, if anything, she has to say.
Well, okay. But here's another thing that's going on. Gretchen Carlson didn't come forward until her contract wasn't renewed. Mm-hmm. So this is not an uncomplicated like moment of feminist triumph. Mm-hmm. There is maybe a little score settling happening here, which that doesn't matter. That's not to say it didn't happen. That's just to say that the timing is, you know, she waited until she knew they weren't going to renew her contract, which is a little, it's tough. And so Megyn Kelly, obviously, you know, is a rising star. She has everything to lose. Like, should she be forced to, you know, come forward? In prepping for this segment, I read some stat that a third of women say they've been sexually harassed at work, which I actually believe, absolutely. And most of them don't come forward because it's just too complicated. Because even if all the procedures are followed, even if you're at the kind of like forward thinking workplace where, you know, action will be immediately taken against the man, you're kind of thought of as someone who couldn't just handle it on your own, who like, you know, had to tell on the guy, you know.
But also, there's a legal reality here, which is that the most severe forms of sexual harassment have workplace consequences. So essentially, Gretchen Carlson is making the argument that her contract wasn't renewed because she didn't reciprocate these sexual advances. And if she had, her contract might have been renewed. So isn't that a reasonable argument to make? Like that it doesn't, maybe it's not, you know, you can sweep it under the rug, haha, I'm married, walk out of the room, and then suddenly you can't because
right.
you see it has real consequences.
It becomes much worse when they don't renew her contract. I agree with that.
Or it becomes a legal argument, like he's retaliating against me for not, it's just a stronger case against someone if you can try and prove that they're retaliating against you.
Right.
As opposed to they just made moves on you, which is also not legal. But to do it with consequences is a much clearer case, I think.
It's interesting that she, Gretchen Carlson, also made accusations against her former co-host on Fox and Friends, who I believe is called Steve Doocy. And that's interesting, too, because that feels like it's about the culture of sort of ambient sexism at Fox, you know, the kinds of things she says Doocy did or, you know, shut her down, essentially shut her up in segments. And that, you know, it's important to remember that it's both these inappropriate sexual advances from Ailes and also this general culture of sexism. I think that having those two things, you know, makes her suit extra powerful. I think if it had just been about the Doocy stuff, I'm not sure we'd even be talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, his stuff was like, oh, they let girls play golf now. It was stuff like that where you think like, oh, that's just some Fox bullshit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but that Fox bullshit, like that Jon Stewart bit where, you know, he just proves that she was acting dumb. You know, the woman went to Stanford. She studied at Oxford. And her shtick on the show was that she was looking up the meaning of words that, you know, a child who did decently on their SATs would know. It's just, of course, she's been playing dumb at Fox as part of her on-air persona for years. You know, there is this is a place that has, it's toxic for women. It's a toxic place.
And but don't you love it? There's like some feminist revolution happening at Fox News. It's like when, you know, when McCain's wife like suddenly gets that sort of like crazy butch haircut. It's like when they just like let, they're like, I'm sick of this smiling crap, like this bimbo crap. And then they just go crazy. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think actually if the culture at Fox News can shift ever so slightly away from not even just traditional gender roles, just like putting women down on air mm-hmm. as a matter of entertainment, mm-hmm. if it can shift 25% away from that, which it seems to all of a sudden be on the course to do, I'm going to like go on the record and say that would probably do more for the cause of women in this country than like most of the efforts made by feminists. Like that would just change very subtly the way a lot of men and women perceive the role of women in this country.
It's true. It's like when network TV does little things like have guys walk around and baby Bjorns or be stay-at-home dads or something. Like in some ways, that has more of an effect on culture norms than lots of other things do.
Yeah.
So are you going to watch Fox News, Maureen?
No.
No. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, The Bachelor and its spinoffs. But before we do that, let's hear from our next sponsor. So it's wedding season. That's my only excuse for talking about The Bachelor.
It's bachelorette season. That's the excuse.
It's bachelorette season. Sorry. The Bachelor slash Bachelorette, the romantic, manipulative, possibly insanely sexist, deeply inspiring show. It's in its 20th season. It's been given a boost by Unreal, which is not exactly a spoof of The Bachelor. It's like a fictional show about the manipulations and the makings of The Bachelor, which is uncannily on point, I have to say. That show, Unreal, was created by someone who was actually a fixer on The Bachelor. I don't know if that's her exact title.
She was a producer for 3 years.
She was a producer on The Bachelor, but she was essentially one of those people who was deep down in the manipulation of the bachelorettes and bachelors to cry and do the various things that they do to create drama. So I will say that I am one of those people who apparently exist in the culture where I watched Unreal first. Like I probably watched The Bachelor many, many years ago, once or twice, but it wasn't like a big part of my life and I completely forgot about it, but I kind of have the tropes in my head. And then I watched some episodes of Unreal and then backed back into The Bachelor. Like somehow watching Unreal made The Bachelor okay to watch again. So let's start by talking about Unreal and its sudden role in the culture. June, I know you're a watcher of Unreal. Can you just say what the deep pleasures of this show are?
Yeah, and I'm another person who came to Unreal first and then had a look at The Bachelorette, which I will not be watching, but that certainly it pushed me.
Had a look. That's a June insult, given how much TV you watch.
It made me have a look. I love Unreal, even though I am not a watcher of the unscripted shows that it is, you know, making fun of, that is meta-commentary upon. But I love, actually, the things I love about it are that it is about ambitious workaholic women who are so dedicated to their jobs and have completely messed up work-life balances. I mean, they are not by any means role models. These are women who are so messed up. But they're also kind of admirable in how dedicated they are to success and to their own success.
And they stand as a contrast to, like, the bachelorettes on the show who all have jobs. I mean, it's listed real estate agent, teacher, stewardess, whatever it is, their jobs, but who at least for the purposes of the show appear as just kind of like heteronormative marriage machines. Like, they're generally sweet. They spend all of their time talking about the guy and their dreams of getting married and the rings. So the tropes are kind of in opposition to each other in the show Unreal.
I mean, sort of. I mean, certainly those women are their playthings. And that, you know, there was a New Yorker profile of Sarah Gertrude Shapiro that honestly made me think that she's not going to have a super long career in television. Just
why? She's the woman who made inspiration for Unreal. She's the producer.
She's the creator of Unreal. And she just is – her personality seems to be one that is a person who talks shit about people, which is great. I mean, like, we love that, not only as journalists, but that – I mean, that profile was really juicy. It had a lot of conflict. But television in particular – is, I mean, to use a cliche, it's a collaborative medium, but it truly, truly is. And in terms of getting jobs and in terms of having your projects backed, I mean, she shit-talked Marty Noxon, who was the person that who was kind of brought in to, like, teach this person who had no experience in scripted television, you know, how to do the job. She, you know, they had a big breakup, essentially, and Shapiro, you know, says mean things about her. She's kind of mean about Lifetime. She's mean about actors. And again, fantastic to read, but not really good for her career, which is too bad because it essentially means that all television people who are going to have long careers tend to say bland things. But
well, I, like you guys, kind of backed into The Bachelorette after Unreal. I'd watched The Bachelor in whatever year, 2002, the first season, not seriously, but I love Unreal. I think it's sort of a perfect show. Mm-hmm. And yet I only want to talk about The Bachelor and Bachelorette because I think they're so fascinating. And I can't believe we haven't talked about them before on this show.
So let's just say that despite what we are saying now about Unreal, The Bachelor and The Bachelorette have tremendous followings.
Yes.
And every single episode is massively, like, chewed over on Twitter and in watching groups and just, like, in every damn place.
And fantasy leagues.
And in particular, what I thought was – I've observed this sort of in my life, and apparently there's some stats to back it up, that well-off women really like watching, and particularly, like, sort of highly educated women, feminists even, really love watching The Bachelor, Bachelorette. There's some stat that I don't have right in front of me, but, like, there's a sort of shockingly high percentage of women viewers who make over $100,000 a year, which is so interesting because, of course, the whole show is about this retrograde beauty contest, whether male or female, where, as Hannah said, they just, like, sort of erase your career and you become – so I am currently
but
watching.
They are not Fox News bimbos. Like, the longer I watch, the less I think it's like – they're not idiot – like, they're not denuded of personality and life.
They create personalities in part by, like, as far as I can tell, feeding them so much white wine that they'll say anything that comes into their head. No, seriously.
No, I think, yeah.
Like, you watch, there are, like, these moments where they start sort of either making out or just, like, kind of cuddling up. And you're like, oh, God, that's, like, I recognize the movements that girl is making. And those are drunk moves. Like, that is, seriously, it's such a thing.
Well, Cosmopolitan talked with actually a woman that Sarah Gertrude Shapiro talked about in the New Yorker profile. Cosmopolitan.com found that woman, and she's a lawyer. She's a pretty high-powered lawyer who was absolutely humiliated by what happened to her on The Bachelor by her own behavior. And she, you know, she wasn't making excuses, but she said, like, they take you away. It's almost a kind of sensory deprivation, that you have no television, that you have no phone, that you have no contact with the outside world. You don't really even know what time it is because it's all about the show. And all you have to do is drink. So they are drunk a lot of the time.
Well, it's totally cult tactics. I mean, totally. What you learn about from the rise of Unreal is actually how the Bachelor gets made, right? I mean, I know that Unreal is an exaggeration, but because of these interviews with the makers of Unreal, like a lot of it is true. You're in a sensory and sort of world deprivation. You don't have contact with your family, including your children. Like there's always the single mom, right? There's the drunk, the single mom, the crazy one, the couple of ethnics that they sprinkle in. I mean, it really is very formulaic. That's how they do it. And, you know, watching Unreal and then watching The Bachelor, I was like, oh, they really do that. There are those tropes. And then, you know, so what happens is that all you end up doing is talking about the cult leader, you know, who is the man or the woman.
It's
so it's
true.
Just like, oh, what is Ben doing? And, oh, Ben's going to leave us a letter. And Ben's going to do this. And Ben's going to do that. And you live in a home together like a harem. Or the dynamics of The Bachelor and The Bachelorette are completely different. But you live in this little harem. And that's like, that's your entire world. You don't know anything else. And so you just get like incredibly, the emotions get jacked up. You know, you're just incredibly excited when he announces that you're going to go play mini golf or whatever. And then you just get incredibly devastated when something happens, which is where I think a lot of the drama comes from.
Well, and it's interesting that you say The Bachelor and Bachelorette are different because they do spend a lot. My frame of reference is this current season of The Bachelorette. So they do spend a lot of time talking about their cult leader, JoJo. But it's not quite a cult leader thing. It's more like she is the ultimate sex object and – you know, there's never been a woman as beautiful as her. And, you know, how do they earn her love? And this guy isn't deserving of her love. He's not even open to love.
Mm-hmm. The Chad.
Chad. I mean, and Chad is like a total villain and crazy. But he does sort of say, like, he says what I found to be one of the more sane things anyone said on the show at one point. He said, I don't know her. I don't know if I'm in love with her. All these guys are sitting here saying that they're in love with JoJo. No one knows that yet. And that was sort of true. And he became, so the herd turned against him when he first started to say that, which was interesting. Like the men are sort of a herd and they are, you know, I'm only on the third episode of the season. So I don't know what happens after I hear Chad gets kicked off. Spoiler alert. But they've all just turned on him and they're doing this male bonding and he and the other guy who's really into weightlifting are isolated on their own and they're made fun of because they weightlift so much, which is just an interesting and they're made fun of because they eat too much meat and they drink too many protein shakes. I mean, the picture of masculinity here is so complicated and they're all dressed in they've all been queer eyed for the straight guide. Like the clothes that they're put in are all super tailored and v-necks and
except like I'm not going to be watching it. It's just and I was going to
June
try
who watches just, like, too heteronormative
no you watch the trashiest TV ever and you
no,
hate this.
It's not about that. It's just that it's dull television to me because it is just one conversation. It's one long conversation that apparently goes on for hours and hours and hours, which is all about what is JoJo thinking and how am I placed in relation to JoJo. It's like live blogging your feelings. You're just like narrating what's going on in your head and like it's not that interesting.
Yeah, I agree actually. I'm fascinated by the aesthetics of it and I'm fascinated by the culture of it, but actually getting through the show, they're an hour and a half long, the ones I've watched so far, and it's kind of a slog.
Yeah, you have to watch it on Fast Forward. I mean,
or
I could
watch
see
it with a group, I think.
Yeah. I could, but as having said that, like, it's not for me. No tea, no shade, but it's just not for me. But I was astonished by certain things, like the sight in this week's episode of three men on a bed, three men and JoJo, so three men and a woman, all essentially in this big, like, hug pile. They were all touching each other on a bed. And, like, in many ways, that's really radical. And these guys also were, like, crying half the time. You know, at the end, it wasn't even just the guy who was eliminated who was crying, and the woman and the man were crying. Like,
white wine tears, white wine
yeah.
tears.
Yeah, and it was...
The men cry a lot. The men cry a lot. They
yeah.
do.
And it's
in
crazy.
The Bachelor, the Bachelor's crying. I'm watching The Bachelor, the Ben Higgins one, and he cries. I mean, they cry.
So what is the masculinity? So the femininity seems pretty straightforward to me. It's very lovely and nice, and they put them in prom dresses.
Yeah.
And they want to get married. But what is the masculinity?
Yeah. To me, the aesthetics of the men are weird because, yeah, obviously they're all hunks, but they're dressed like little boys. Like they're so this, the one, you know, my experience is one episode. They're in Argentina. It's casual. So they're essentially in like tank tops and shorts. And then, you know, when they did the elimination, whatever you call it, they look like they were little boys in their dad's suits. Like they, the couple that were wearing ties, like the shirt wasn't on properly, and the tie, it was like, it really was like little kids. They did not look good, which surprised me because, I mean, it goes without saying, they're very attractive men with super cool hair, but they didn't look, they look like children.
I think they're like, I mean, maybe I shouldn't go down this road, but I think they're weird looking. They're like...
Yeah, I mean, I think they look like children. I think you're responding to the fact that they have been put together by other people. And I think that that's what Unreal makes us highly aware of, mm-hmm. that these producers are these godlike figures who are engineering everything, and including their hair, their look, their personalities, like which one is going to play which role. And that, you know, that's why I think Unreal has kind of freed me to enjoy The Bachelor and The mm-hmm. Bachelorette, because like I'm aware of that. There's no doubt about that. And I kind of like to watch it. It's like watching The Truman Show or something. It's like there are these God people who are putting people in different positions. And I think then, like, the thing I like about it is this idea, it's like the persistence of the love story. Like, mm-hmm. by which I mean, like, every person's ability to spin a story about love, which I think people do every day when they write profiles on OkCupid, and then kind of live inside this story. It's like we do, even though you know it's not true, this is something people do all the time. Like you read, you know, the profiles are not real, like the version of yourself you're presenting is not real, but there's like a little part of you that believes that and wants that, or like what you might do on a first date. And that's like what's beautiful to me about The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, that like we have this stupid human capacity to do that over and over and over again. And it's like stupid but optimistic at the same time. And then they just kind of like keep repeating that. I mean, I don't think I can watch it forever, but I'm definitely enjoying my deep dive at the moment. Let's end it there. All right, let's do our recommendations. But before we do that, let's hear from our final sponsor. Okay, recommendations. June, what do you have for us this week?
Well, first of all, I just want to give one more plug for our colleague Jessica Winter's fantastic new novel, Break in Case of Emergency, which is officially out this week. It's funny. It's really profound about things like fertility and marriage and friendship and, you know, making it in the world of work. Highly recommended. But I also want to recommend a memoir by Barbara Cook, the singer, and, you know, someone who's very famous for her interpretation of the Great American Songbook. She has a new memoir called Then and Now. And I have to admit, I bought it to send to a friend who's a big Barbara Cook fan. And I just was going to look at it just to find something to make fun of, because he's such a Barbara Cook fan. And I've just been poking fun at him for that for years. And I was so overwhelmingly charmed by it that it has become one of the favorite things that I've read this year. So she was an absolute superstar of musical theater, and then she became an alcoholic and spent decades where she almost literally couldn't get out of bed. And she has a very sort of charming voice. I mean, and she doesn't hide the fact that she worked with a ghostwriter. She's very open. She's not falsely modest. She knows she has a fantastic voice. She knows she has a fantastic voice, one of the greats. But she knows also where her weaknesses are. And she talks about her problems with drink, problems with weight. But then she also really shares things that just feel very real, and is just such a charming sort of companion through, you know, musical theater in the last 60 years. She's in her late 80s now. She's going on 90. She even has sort of dish from, you know, appearing at the White House, singing at the White House. So I really recommend Then and Now by Barbara Cook.
Excellent. All right. My recommendation is far more mainstream, which is, since we were talking about the cultiness of The Bachelor, The Girls by Emma Klein, which I'm reading simultaneously while watching The Bachelor, which is actually truly excellently written. It's about an invented Manson girl, and her just kind of, it sort of flashbacks and back and forth to her teenage years when she drifted into the Manson clan. and then her current life. And it's really beautifully realized portrait of this troubled soul. And that's my recommendation, except you should all listen to Invisibilia, my NPR show. I realize I have not been on XX since Invisibilia came out. So everyone listen to it.
I just listened to the first episode of the season, and I can confirm you should listen. There's a great story of Hannah going to an oil rig.
Yeah, which is gendery. Like it gendery, has yeah. gender stuff in it. Okay, Noreen, to you.
So I'm going to do two books because I've sort of paired them in my mind in a weird way. So the first one is a book I came across in a used bookstore. It was written in the 90s by Calvin Trillin, the New Yorker writer, called Remembering Denny. And it's about a classmate of his at Yale who was a Rhodes Scholar, sort of a generational talent who really never lived up to that potential. And although he had a very successful life and ended up committing suicide in his 50s, and it turned out so Trillin goes back, tries to reconstruct what happened in his life. Was it, you know, was it all the pressure of being a Rhodes Scholar? It turns out that he was also a closeted gay man, and so it's really about identity and
also disappointment. That's yes. it's a really good book.
Yes. Yes. So then I finished that and then began reading In the Dark Room, which I'm still reading, but it's a memoir or sort of a reported story about her father by Susan Faludi, who, you know, is sort of an eminent journalist, feminist. But her father, it turns out about 10 years ago, well into his 70s, transitioned to becoming a woman. And so Faludi goes back and looks at her father's life. He'd had a really interesting life where he'd grown up in Hungary before World War II. His family was Jewish, and then moved to America where he, you know, tried to be sort of a traditional father, and that didn't exactly take. And it's really elegant and subtle, and the family history stuff is really, really interesting. And she explores what identity means and beyond just sort of the obvious gender thing in this case, you know, the way.
And she doesn't like him. I reviewed the book for The Washington Post. That's, to me, a lot of the tension in the book is that this is a father who she thinks of as essentially having terrorized her and her mother during their childhood, as being oppressive, never listening to them. And then suddenly, you know, he's at the forefront of, you know, gender fluidity and change. And so she's got to reconcile these two instincts she has about him. And it's like she grudgingly goes to visit him. And then, you know,
and she's angry.
And she's angry. Yeah. I mean, it's a book about lots of different things, like gender fluidity, identity at this moment, kind of personal reconciliation with a parent mm-hmm. who you don't like. Can you forgive?
I haven't gotten to the reconciliation part yet.
Oh, sorry.
No,
I'm not
okay.
saying it's just about that.
Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
that she reconciles, but it's about that, like, can you do that even with a parent that you don't like?
Yeah.
It's a great book. I loved it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you to our producer, Anne Hepperman. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern, Daniel Schrader. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. Show page for more information is slate.com/xx. Or you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to send us recommendations or comments about the show, or email us at XXGabFest@slate.com. And also subscribe on iTunes and everywhere where you can get your podcasts so more people find out about this show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Sie ist eine Powerfrau, die alles Tricks kennt im Communication from Consulting Multi-Management. It's the main assistant, chief controlling analyst. Ich hab bis heute noch nicht verstanden, was das ist.